This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
Hi, it's Glenn Beck, and I want to thank you for supporting The Blaze. Because of your phone calls and emails, The Blaze has been added by many TV providers. But we can't stop now. The big media companies like DirecTV, Comcast, and Time Warner aren't listening. They think CNN, MSNBC, and Al Jazeera America are all you need. But we humbly disagree, and we think you do too. Visit GetTheBlaze.com and let your TV provider know that you want The Blaze in your home. GetTheBlaze.com. Thanks.
Will Kane, S.E. Cup, R. Kane and Cup, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hey, it's S.E. Cup here. It's Kane and Cup, although we're one shy. Will Kane's not here. You just missed it. He and I got into a bit of an argument. He stormed out in a huff when I told him real bros can grow beards. I don't know where he is. I don't know if he's coming back. That's a lie. He's out for a family event, which is so much more boring than my made-up version of how things went. So you're stuck with me for the next 3 hours. Thanks for spending your Saturday morning with me. I promise to make it worth your while, or while, as Will would say. We've got a lot of fun guests today, some old friends, some of whom you will definitely know. And some new friends, maybe people you don't know, but you're going to meet today. I'm really excited because broadcasting today live from Washington, D.C., where I live. And after this, going to go out and watch a baseball game. My New York Mets are playing the Washington Nationals. And it's a gorgeous day down here. Great day for a ball game. Let's play two. I haven't been to a ball game all summer. And there was a time I used to go once, like every other week in the summer, which is crazy pants, I know, but that's how into it I was. I'd go to Shea back when Shea Stadium still existed. I'd go once every other week. So great when I didn't have like a job to worry about. But I'm a grown up now. So once a year is lucky, but I'm really excited. So today, couple fun treats for you. I've asked a doctor friend of mine to come in and help us answer really stupid medical questions. Like really stupid. In fact, if you have any, I want you to tweet me at SE Cup and I'm gonna pass them on. But let me just set up some ground rules. He's a psychologist. He's that kind of doctor. So no questions about like toe fungus and pink eye. You can save that for your physician or Google. I'm thinking more like fetishes and phobias. Questions that you think are either really dumb or a little embarrassing. Like so embarrassing you wouldn't ask your real doctor. Because Dr. Fuller's coming on and he is here. He's going to answer some of my questions, which are most important because they're really stupid. And then if you have good ones, tweet me those embarrassing questions. I'll pass them on. And maybe he'll be able to give you a little radio psychology. I got to tell you, Will is going to be really ticked because he's been dying to do this segment, like Ask a Doctor. But I promise we'll have Dr. Fuller back when Will is back with us. But think of something really great to ask him. We're also going to talk today about the new dangers of data mining. I don't know if you've heard about this, but there is a ton of information that education companies are getting from your children. Personal information, like millions of pieces of information. And it's like the Wild Wild West. We don't know if they're selling that information. We don't know if they're cataloging it and using it in a way that would make us very uncomfortable. I'm going to tell you about that later in the show. It's scary stuff. It's stuff I think we should start thinking about for sure. Also, fun little treat. John's in studio. You might remember John. He's played on Game of Bros once or twice. He also happens to be my husband. John, say hi.
Morning.
Oh. Was that your radio voice?
That's my radio voice. I'm excited to be here.
Wow. So he might weigh in from time to time. But first I want to get to the big news of the week. And I imagine you folks you have opinions on this. And you can feel free to call in on our broad voice phone line. It's 888-900-3393. The VA scandal. I mean, this is the news of the week. This is a big deal, to quote Joe Biden. Despite the attempts by the left to brush this off, this is a huge, huge scandal. Eric Shinseki, the secretary of the VA, is fighting for his job after 40 veterans died. That's right, died while waiting to receive care in Arizona. And they died because of a cover-up. They were put on a secret waiting list that was kept private from officials like Shinseki and presumably others. It's not the only example of this. Just a couple of days ago, three mental health administrators at the Malcolm Randall VA Medical Center in Gainesville, Florida, were placed on administrative leave after officials found another secret waiting list of more than 200 patients. It's a punch in the gut is what it is, because these are the people we care deeply about. These are the people who have sacrificed their home lives, their family time, life and limb to protect us. And we're not taking care of them when they get home. Now, Secretary Shinseki, for his part, there was a hearing on Thursday and he was sort of defending the VA and defending himself. He has said he refuses to resign. He's not going anywhere. It's really audacious. Take a listen to what Shinseki has to say about this.
Any allegation, any adverse incident like this makes me mad as hell. I could use stronger language here, Mr. Chairman, but in deference to the committee, I won't.
It's really great to know that he's mad as hell. That's comforting. I'm glad. He should be mad as hell. He should also step down. 100% he should also step down. I'm going to tell you why in a little bit. This is not Eric Shinseki's first disaster at the VA. But let's stick with this, because what I find, I've been talking about this all week, of course, and what I find appalling is that the left is trying not only to brush this off, but to turn it around on, guess who? Republicans. That's right. 40 veterans died in Arizona because of Republicans. It's a disgusting political charge, and I want to spend some time with you this morning arming you for that conversation, because I don't think it's a conversation I'm just having like on television. I think people are talking about how we can prevent this, who's to blame. And if you're sitting across the table after church or your dinner table or with friends or at a game or whatever, and someone says to you, this is a Republican's fault, or this isn't President Obama's responsibility, or this isn't Eric Shinseki's responsibility, or this isn't a reflection of colossal failure on the part of big government bureaucracy, I want you to be armed with things to say. So go get yourself a pen and a piece of paper. I'm going to give you your bullet points, so to speak. Your talking points, as we call them in this business, to refute these absolutely asinine and appalling arguments. Because getting to the bottom of this should be job number one. Figuring out who's responsible instead of distracting and trying to save political skin in this. So charge number one you're going to hear, I heard it all week, is we wouldn't have this problem if it weren't for Bush. Bush didn't get us into all these wars. I'd like you to remind your friend who says this that, of course, Democrats authorized both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Democrats. Bush didn't unilaterally just go in. I know that charge is thrown around a lot. Democrats authorized these wars. But this is beside the point, because blaming Republicans for the existence of veterans is shameful. And I want you to say that. It's like arguing over how you got pregnant. You have a baby. Now you have to take care of it. It doesn't matter how it happened. You have a kid. We have veterans. It doesn't matter why we have them. We have them. And it is our job to take care of them. So I really want you to point an indignant finger at a friend who says, we wouldn't have this problem if it weren't for Bush, because That's disgusting. Charge number two you're going to hear, Republicans voted against more funding that would have eased these backlogs and wait times. If that sounds familiar, it is. Democrats tried to use this in Benghazi as well. Democrats tried to say, well, we would have had all of the staffing and funding and security we needed in Libya had Republicans just authorized it. Now, we quickly learned in our hearings that that was not the case. The State Department itself said this was not a funding issue in Benghazi. Well, that's also true in the VA scandal. Now, the VA since 2001 has doubled its funding. In fact, it's more than doubled its funding. And according to the VA itself, this is great. This is so rich. This is a great stat for you to throw out at your friends. The VA itself says it spent $2.2 billion in waste, fraud, and abuse just in 2012. The VA can't manage the money it already has. And if you needed further ammunition, at Thursday's hearing this week, expert after expert resoundingly rejected the idea that funding was the problem. Look, the VA has more than 300,000 employees. It's more than like something like three Walmarts, corporate Walmarts. And it has more money than it needs, more money that it can even manage. The problem is not money or staffing. The problem is unwieldy bureaucracy. Charge number three you're going to hear, the administration is taking this seriously, so let them do their job. Right. I'm sorry, the administration is not taking this seriously. President Obama has said, get this, he still has full confidence in Eric Shinseki. Good God, why? Based on what? It's unbelievable. The truth is Obama is circling the wagons. He is protecting Shinseki like he protected Susan Rice, Eric Holder, Hillary Clinton, Kathleen Sebelius, when they all presided over scandals and failures. Now, speaking of Eric Holder, he also has no plans to investigate the mess at the VA. No, he's happy to let the VA investigate the VA. I'm sure I don't have to remind you guys that this is a Justice Department that has investigated media leaks, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, ebook price fixing, and a whole host of other things, but it won't investigate the deaths of 40 veterans? Are you kidding? It's happy to let the Inspector General do it. Now, let me also remind you that Shinseki himself said on Thursday in this hearing that the Inspector General is already overloaded with inquiries. He can't handle the workload he has, which is part of the problem that led to the current VA scandal. He can't handle the inquiries he has. No, but we'll just let things take their course, like we did at the IRS. Who needs a special prosecutor when there are well-meaning inspectors general appointed by the president to investigate the scandals at the departments overseen by the president, at agencies that answer to the president? That makes total sense to me. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I've got more for you. I've got more ammunition because I want you to know how you're going to respond to these ludicrous charges. That's coming up on Kane and Cup.
Will Kane and S.E. Cup.
We'll continue in a moment on the Blaze Radio Network.
Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. It's Kane and Cup. I'm S.E. Cup. Will is at an undisclosed location. That's all I can say. We've been talking about the Veterans Affairs scandal, as I'm sure you have been at home, because it's deeply troubling. This, I think, hits close to home for a lot of us who know veterans, who are in veteran families, who are military families. I mean, I can't think of anything more tragic than a soldier coming home after sacrificing life and limb and not getting the care that he or she needs once you're back in the United States. So it's really important that we get to the bottom of this. And I'm arming you this morning with with arguments, because the left is, for political reasons, of course, completely unwilling to get to the bottom of this because they're too busy protecting President Obama, Eric Shinseki, and big government. There's too much at stake for the left to admit there might be a problem somewhere. Because if they admit that this is a bureaucracy problem, then they have to admit this is a bureaucracy, that there are bureaucracy problems everywhere. So they've got to hold up the massive, overfunded, overstaffed VA as a bastion of good government. Otherwise, the whole house of cards collapses. So we talked about some of the charges that you're going to hear. This is Bush's fault. Republicans voted against funding. The administration's taking this seriously. I have another one for you. Here's a good one. This one really boggles my mind, but I heard it a number of times this week. Eric Shinseki should stay. He was doing a great job. It was the people under him who messed up. This is my favorite, because without knowing it, Democrats are completely making my point here that regardless of how great the guy at the top may be, if he's sitting on top of a pile of crap, then what good is he? And the VA system, I'm sorry to say, with all its money and staff and bureaucracy, is a pile of crap. It is not running right. It's not getting our veterans the care they need. It is, as Joe Klein of Time Magazine said, no friend of conservatives, he said it's perhaps the worst bureaucracy in Washington. It's a bureaucracy that allowed bureaucrats in Arizona to keep a secret list. The guy's under Shinseki. So why would you tell me that it's working well? Eric Shinseki is great. He wanted to do all these amazing things. It's just the people under him. No kidding. That's what happens in a bureaucracy you can't manage. It doesn't matter what your best laid plans are. If you don't have people to implement it, the bureaucracy is out of control. The other part of this is that Shinseki was not, in fact, doing a great job. This is what he said Thursday about the problem at the VA, the reason those 40 vets died in Arizona. He said, this is a robust system. A good portion of it works. And what we're focused on is scheduling as an issue. Scheduling. That's right. So backlogs of 180 days and secret lists that keep vets from getting care they need is a scheduling problem. That is absurd. And like I said before, this was not Shinseki's first rodeo, my friends. Senators at the hearing this week brought up 50 federal reports in recent years, 50 warning of problems at the VA long before this quote unquote scheduling problem erupted in Arizona. My friend Jake Tapper at CNN grilled the White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough on Thursday, and he brought up that in 2011, multiple deaths in Pittsburgh from Legionnaire's disease went unaccounted for. The folks in charge there were never held to account. Last year, Congressman Jeff Miller sent a letter to the president warning of the systemic failures at the VA. He got a form letter back. Listen to this. Jake Tapper, I thought, said it best in this interview with Dennis McDonough. Play cut two.
How many stories like this, how many letters like this, how many dead veterans do you need before somebody asks the question within the White House, maybe this guy isn't the best steward of these veterans?
You cannot put it better than that. You cannot put it better than that. Shinseki has got to go. And it's not because firing Eric Shinseki is going to fix the problems. It won't. But it's because criminal negligence has gone on under his watch, and he needs to be held accountable. I mean, enough is enough. I don't understand why Democrats, including President Obama and Eric Holder, wouldn't want to clear the decks on this and get it out of the way. Fire Eric Shinseki. Give us a fall guy. We'll have our hearings. We'll try to get to the bottom of what's going on at the VA. But the protecting, the cover-up makes it worse. I don't understand the political calculus on this, other than their knee-jerk reaction is to defend themselves. It's absurd. It's appalling. Well, I hope that was helpful, because I feel like I gave you all of the arguments you're going to hear, the ludicrous arguments, and hopefully the ways to defend against them, because it's really important we don't let the left turn this around. Okay, coming up, my friend Rick Santorum's going to join us. I have some questions for him. I think he might be running for president. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network. Part of the next generation of talk radio, Kane and Cup, is on.
Hey, it's SE Cup here for Kane and Cup. Will Kane is being punished for saying bad words on the air. That's why he's not here today. No, that's not true. He's off for a family event. Wah, wah. Wouldn't it be awesomer? Yeah, awesomer. If that were really the case, that he wasn't here because he was being punished for saying naughty words on the air.
Ephemeral.
Well, that's just Will not being able to pronounce stuff. Oh, Will. We miss him. We miss him. He'll be back. But joining us right now, friend of mine, Senator Rick Santorum, to talk about his new book. His new book is Blue Collar Conservatives. And it's got a great message. And I think you're going to be hearing a lot about it. Senator Santorum, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you, SC. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Now, you argue that the GOP has been too obsessed and focused on the top earners and not focused enough on the working man. Tell me what you mean.
Well, if you think about what the Republican message has been on the economy for quite some time now, it's really three pillars. Number one, balance the budget. Number two, cut benefits and entitlement programs. And number three, cut taxes, but specifically focused. And the real argument is always about cutting taxes for the highest income people to, quote, create growth and create jobs. Now, do I agree with all those? Yes, I do. Do I think that is a good economic plan as far as creating growth and long-term stability for the government and for our country? Yes, I do. Do I think it communicates a very good, positive, uplifting message for the vast majority of Americans who neither receive government benefits or are in the top income earners or have any idea how a balanced budget affects them? No, I don't. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. We talk as macroeconomists about growth, and we leave behind people figuring, well, how does this help me? And that's been the disconnect between Republicans and millions of blue collar and average working people in America who are struggling, who are feeling like the Democratic Party is killing them with the economy, but at least they're throwing a bone to them every now and then, saying, you know, we're going to give you Obamacare, we're going to give you food stamps. They know it ultimately can't last, but it's better than a party that ignores them and doesn't have anything to say.
Yeah, well, you know, I never understood why in 2012 with Occupy Wall Street and all the angst over the 1% and the income inequality gap and bailing out the banks, the GOP decided to nominate a millionaire private equity guy. Now, I like Mitt Romney. He's a good person. Yeah, he probably had some good ideas, but wasn't he just the wrong candidate at the wrong time?
I talk about this in the book, and I say a lot of nice things about Mitt Romney, and I say them because I mean them. But and I supported him in 2008 against John McCain, but he was not the right candidate for this time. And you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the whole narrative that the Democratic Party was spinning was 1% versus 99. And so we nominate a Wall Street financier. You can't make this up. And this is why you see the Tea Party and you see so many Republican, based voters across this country really angry. I mean, really angry at these funders in New York and Washington and these pundits who just simply can't see the nose in the mirror in front of them. This is the angst. And people say, well, how did you do so well? The reason I did so well against Mitt Romney was not because I was the only person standing. I was the only person standing because I went out and talked about manufacturing and energy and blue collar jobs and doing things that, that connected with people who were outside this little bubble that, that is the establishment Republicans on the East Coast.
Mm. Well, it, don't we always do that, though? I mean, anyone could have told you after Bush, after W, that the country wanted someone young and fresh and exciting. And so the left nominates Barack Obama and we give them John McCain. I mean, how do we break the GOP's cycle of tone deafness when it comes time to nominate presidents?
And here's the problem, Essie. And the problem is that the Democratic Party is perfectly aligned. And what I mean by that is the Democratic base are a bunch of lefties, progressives, hardcore, you know, radicals. And that's who they are. That's what motivates them. That's who their base is. That's who their volunteers are. But also, Essie, that's who their funders are. Their funders are left-wing folks. They're the unions. They're the trial lawyers. They're, you know, the pro-abortion, the environmentalist groups. That's who they are. The Republican Party is not aligned. The Republican base is conservative. It's right down the line. They actually believe in everything that's in the Republican platform and believe that that's best for America. The problem is the funders of the Republican Party, the quote establishment, are not lined up with the platform. And therefore, what happens is the people with the money in the campaigns are the folks who actually think more like Democrats than Republicans on many issues. And so that's why there's this battle within the Republican Party right now, because the establishment and the money doesn't agree with the rest of the base. They call them Tea Party, but they're not Tea Party. Some of them are, but they're just conservatives who want a conservative candidate, a conservative message, and for us to quit saying we have to run away from what we believe in order to win, when we know that that's best for America, and then we know that it can win if we actually have candidates that can go out and communicate that message.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about something along those lines. Let me ask you about the minimum wage, because I know you've been advocating for increases in the minimum wage for a long time. I don't know if this is new for Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney, because I remember in 2012, Mitt Romney opposed a raise, but I know as governor, he was for a raise. I don't know where he's been, but I know where you've been on it. But I don't get it, because the CBO and a slew of economists say that raising the minimum wage will slow hiring and hurt the very people it's intending to help. So explain to me why you have always and continue to support it.
Yeah, the reason I support a minimum wage is because if you look back historically, when the minimum wage has been raised to what it is historically, and there have been one or two outliers, but when it's been historically raised to cover anywhere from 5 to 7% of the population, it doesn't have an inflationary effect. It doesn't have an effect, what's very, very, very minimal effect on unemployment. And it does have the effect of creating a floor of wages. So what Barack Obama supported, and Ted Kennedy before him when I was in the Senate, they've supported something more like a living wage, which is a dramatic increase in the minimum wage that covers, you know, 15% of the population or more's wages. That would be inflationary. That would cost jobs. And I don't support that. But if you look back historically in this country since the 1930s, when the wages have been raised to, you know, 5 to 7% of wages covered by the minimum wage, you'll find that the impact is actually not, not deleterious at all. Here's the other thing, Essie. The optics stink. I mean, this is a party that is just focused on business. And you know what? They'll bail out Wall Street. They'll take care of, they'll have their crony capitalist ideas. But when it comes to the working man, it hurts the economy. You know, if we were consistent,
I know it's a tough sell.
You might make the argument, but we're not consistent.
Mm. Well, listen, my husband, John, who I know you've met, he's in studio with me. He has a question for you. Go ahead, John.
Senator, the left and the media want to force GOP candidates to talk about social issues all the time. But what we have to say about economics and everything else are so great. What advice would you give to a candidate to not fall into the trap and to be able to talk about the things that will really set us apart, not just social issues?
Yeah, you know, you're asking the wrong candidate about this, because I've had to learn that lesson. Maybe the right person. I've had to learn this lesson the hard way. I'll never forget during the campaign, I gave a speech on manufacturing, and I went down and worked the rope line, and there were a bunch of reporters there. And one reporter goes up and he asked me this question about abortion, and so, you know, I'm the candidate that, you know, I'm out there, I answer every question. So I answered the question.
Yeah.
Worked down the line, the reporter comes back, asks me a question about, you know, gay marriage. And then he asked me a question about, you know, religious liberty. And then he finally looks at me and says, you know, Senator, why are you always talking about social issues?
That actually
happened. I'm not
amazing.
It actually happened. So here's here's what we have to understand. That media, we have no responsibility to the media to answer their questions. We don't. We really don't have a responsibility. Now, we have a responsibility to communicate and openly talk to the American public about what we believe, yes. But that doesn't have to answer every reporter's question. And nor do we have to answer exactly what he wants to get out of that question. And so what I believe is we have to talk about what our vision is for this country. And when the reporter wants to ask about marriage, I'm happy to talk about marriage with respect to how marriage is important for the economic growth of our country, which it is.
Yeah. No, but I think you always do it right, because, and I've told you this before, we've talked about this before, you always tie social issues to economic consequences and vice versa. I think that's the way to do it. Let me ask you one last question. If you run for president, Senator Santorum, and Hillary runs for president, how will you beat her?
Well, I mean, I think it creates a wonderful contrast. I really do. If we need contrast. That's the problem we've had in the last few elections, that we haven't really had a contrast. We haven't had someone who's gone out there and articulated in a way that connects with average people what the message is of the Republican Party. And I think Hillary is so establishment on the other side and so has such a rich record, and that it creates a wonderful opportunity for a conservative candidate to go out there and hit her on across the board for her extreme positions and how out of touch she's been over a long period of time.
Yeah. Are you going to ask her if she has brain damage?
No.
Good.
No. No, I'm going to leave that one aside. I'll let other people deal with that issue.
I think that's really smart.
I've been accused, as a conservative, I get accused of that on a regular basis by the left, but I guess they don't really consider it the same thing.
Right. All right, Senator Santorum, thanks for joining us today. The book is Blue Collar Conservatives. Thanks for everything. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Jesse. Bye-bye.
All right, guys, stay tuned. There's a lot more coming up in the show. Senator Santorum is just one of the friends who's going to join us today. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned. Kane and Kupp.
You're listening to Kane and Kupp on the Blaze Radio Network.
Kane and Kupp returns now.
Welcome back. I'm S.E. Kupp. I want to go to some callers we have now who wanted to weigh in on the VA scandal. I'm interested to hear. Let's go to our Broad Voice call line to Archie in California. What's up, Archie?
Yeah. I think it's horrifying that they would do this.
Who they?
Well, Obama, the people who are supposed to be in charge doing this, but of course we also have to realize they did this in Benghazi too. They blamed the internet video, which no one bothered with, instead of taking responsibility for their actions.
Well, yeah, that's hard to argue with, Archie, and thanks for calling. There is a pattern here of CYA. There is a pattern here in this administration of cover your behind and protect your own, deflect, politicize, protect the administration above all else. I saw that with the IRS. I saw a huge sort of lack of curiosity about what was going on at the IRS from this administration. And you know how long it's taken to get answers on Benghazi.
It's ultimate job security. I don't know what you have to do to get fired from this administration.
No.
Look down the line and, you know, nobody goes.
Nobody goes. You don't see heads roll. Even in the face of tremendous adversity. I mean, think of Kathleen Sebelius. If anyone should have been a fall guy, even just, like I've said, to clear the decks.
If I'm an elected official and I have someone that's causing me scandal and some heartburn in public, I'm going to get rid of them.
Yeah.
What's the loyalty? Get rid of them.
Let's go to Kenny in Texas. Kenny, we don't have a ton of time, but tell me what's on your mind with this VA scandal.
I was going to say the real reason they're circling the wagons on this VA scandal is because of Obamacare. Because if voters put two and two together, that Obamacare is going to turn their health care into the VA system, it's going to be bad for them come the midterms.
Yeah, I've heard this. I mean, I've talked to a number of vets. My friend Pete Hegseth at Concerned Vets for America made this point that this is a preview. It's a preview of Obamacare. It is top-down government health care run terribly with rationing and wait lists and secret lists. I think you're absolutely right, Kenny, and thanks for the call, that people are concerned not only about the VA scandal because we deeply care about our veterans, but because we know deep down inside, in like the dark recesses of our minds, this could portend something truly terrible for Obamacare.
Yeah, you don't want to force them to admit that bureaucracy and government-run healthcare may not work so well as they've told us it will.
Well, they never will. They will never admit that. And that's what I mean. The stakes are too high for this administration to really admit to much of anything here. In fact, the best course for them would be to say, this is all Eric Shinseki's fault. The bureaucracy is fine. The VA is fine. It's poorly run at the top. Chop the head off the snake. That would be in their best interest. It would be a lie, but it would be in their best interest to protect the bureaucracy they so deeply, deeply love.
Yeah, I agree. There's this weird sense of loyalty where someone who just can't do their job is held safe and secure and covered up for when the easiest thing to do is to get rid of them.
New York, play cut two again. Play Jake Tapper again. It's really good.
Stories like this, how many letters like this, how many dead veterans do you need before somebody asks the question within the White House, maybe this guy isn't the best steward of these veterans?
I mean, it's pretty common sense. Kudos to Jake for he put that to the White House chief of staff. It's great. I don't get it. I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me, and it's deeply offensive. It's deeply offensive that these things keep happening in this administration. All right, we've got a great hour ahead, so stay tuned to Kane and Cup. We're coming right back.
You're listening to Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network. Kane and Cup, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hey, it's Essie Cup. This is Kane and Cup. Well, Kane is out for some dental work. Nose job. Just kidding. He's got a family event of some sort this weekend, so you're stuck with me. But I think that's good news, because we've got a whole bunch of people coming in today's show. And if Will were here, there might just not be room for them all. Be a little crowded in the studio. I've also got my husband in here with me. John, say hi.
Hey, everyone.
Hello. That's his deep put-on radio voice. I want you to know he doesn't talk like that at home. Say hi again.
Hi.
You're trying to be Elvis Duran.
No, this is legit. This is what I sound like. Promise.
Okay. Fact. Science. Call in on our broad voice call line if you want to chat with us. It's 888-900-3393. I want to tell you a scary story.
How scary?
It's pretty scary. Maybe put the kids to bed. Actually, it involves your kids, so you might want to have them around. But we talked a lot on Real News, our show on The Blaze, and I mean all over The Blaze Network about big data. We've talked about NSA and the government collecting your information, and there are all kinds of privacy concerns about that, of course. The latest on that front is data mining your kids. That's real.
That's not cool.
It's not cool, right? It immediately sounds scary.
Yeah, it's like clown scary. I mean, that's scary.
Yes, it is clown level scary. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you a little bit about it. And I only learned about it. I'll give props out to Politico, Stephanie Simon, who wrote a long piece on it this week. I would not have known about this. I don't have kids, so I'm not like keyed into this issue. And in fact, if Will were here, Will has a big focus on education. And so maybe he's aware of this, but I had not really heard much about this. And I have to think that I'm pretty plugged in. So if I haven't been up on this, maybe our listeners haven't either. So I want to inform you of what's going on. There is an ed tech startup firm called Newton. It's K-N-E-W-T-O-N, Newton. And it basically has access to 4 million student brains across the country. And let me write, it's a startup, okay? It's a startup.
So that's going to grow. They're going to get access to more brains.
What I'm saying, John, is it's going to grow.
Wow.
Exactly. 4 million to start. And basically, every time your kids work through like digital textbooks, and I'm sure people at home know what I'm talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm sure they know what I'm talking about. Digital textbooks and like education website portals, you know, where teachers will send your kids online through certain web portals to do online homework and research projects and interact with other students. That every time they do that, Newton collects data. Newton can find out what the student knows, how they think, who has trouble focusing on science before lunch, who will struggle with fractions next Thursday, that kind of stuff. And basically what they say, what firms like Newton and others say, is that the goal is to identify potential problems early and help kids cope with them. You know, if we have all of these data points, we can figure out, okay, this is a student who might benefit from X, Y, or Z, or this is a student that maybe should be in a different class, something like that. I mean, the goal sounds good and not nefarious.
I'm always skeptical of these data collection schemes, though, and that makes me nervous.
No, exactly. Let me, because these companies are scooping up as many as 10 million unique data points on each child each day. My mind just exploded. I didn't know a child had 10 million data points.
No, that's a lot.
That sounds like a lot of data points. I mean, I couldn't even begin to process what those data points are. 10 million in a day a child has. What? What? That's
no,
too many data points.
That number is too big for me in my math.
Well, and actually, anyway, they say that's more data than Netflix, Facebook, or even Google collect on their users.
Wow.
I know. And basically, a study by McKinsey last year found that expanding this use of data in K-12 schools could drive $300 billion a year in added economic growth in the U.S. by improving instruction and making education more efficient. This seems like a racket in the making, right?
Sure. I mean,
having all of this data is going to make your kids smarter.
Yeah,
really?
It sounds like a guise to me, but you know, who doesn't support that effort? I mean, everybody wants their kids to do better in school. And
I'm so glad you asked, because apparently both Republicans and Democrats have embraced this practice.
Sure. But there's the devil's in the details. It makes me nervous. Where does this data go? Is this telling my parents to buy Pudding Pops and Teddy Grahams? We don't know where the data ends up eventually.
Exactly. So parents and school administrators have tried to ask that very question, and they're finding it's nearly impossible to find out which companies are collecting their data and how it's being used. They can't get any, even school administrators can't get answers as to where this data is going. And I mean, there are some speculations. According to this story, you know, who can say for sure that a student is not being rebuffed by maybe a future employer because their personal profile has been mined and sold to someone? There are very few laws against selling this data. And school districts can write in privacy protections into their contracts with these ed tech companies. Most don't. In fact, they found only 7% of the contracts between districts and tech companies barred the companies from selling it for profit. So yes, who are they selling it to? Exactly. These streams of metadata that companies collect when kids work online can be sold to anyone.
There's also a scary sort of minority report aspect to this to me as well, is, you know, what a kid looks up that might have to do with firearms or the military, are they going to profile him for having those sort of leanings with the school's administrators and others? I mean, that's another scary aspect to me. I mean, kids have all sorts of fantasies and ideas when they're kids. 10 million a day, apparently.
Yeah, it actually talks about how this could be sold to the military. Not in that way. It talks about for recruitment. Mm-hmm. But sure. I mean, it is a Pandora's box. It is the wild, wild west. And I think it's even more sensitive because you're thinking about protecting kids from this kind of privacy breach. It's crazy. There is legislation that should oversee this, but it's ancient. It was written in 1974. It's called FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. And it explicitly gives school districts the right to share students' personal information with private companies if it is to further educational goals. Now, you can't share like standardized test scores or like disciplinary history and confidential records. But if it is to further educational goals, that is
a gray area. How do you define educational
goals? It sounds like if it's in the interest of national security.
Exactly.
Well, then you can share. Well, that's very gray, too.
It's a big umbrella.
Right. So under this 1974 law, FERPA, you're allowed to do this. School districts are allowed to share your data. It's really scary stuff. I don't know what the answer is. The good news is, believe it or not, Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, so bipartisan, on just this Wednesday began circulating a draft bill to update FERPA from 1974, which might as well be the Stone Age, to 2014, to recognize the vast newness of these technologies and data mining and put in some protections for our children.
Well, I think that's smart. And what little I do know about the tech world and this sort of thing is that a lot of companies, the end goal is to acquire this data and to sell it. So regardless,
it is the only goal, in fact, and the other stuff is sort of front loading a front.
That's exactly right. And that goes from everything from, you know, voter registration to whatever. I mean, the data is the end goal, which really scares me when it comes to your kids. I mean, it could be the guise of better education, but we just don't know.
Yeah. And there's no opt out. Right. This is the problem so often with schooling. There's no opt out.
Right. Can your kid choose to go back to the dead tree to read his work, or
yes,
is he stuck with the online stuff only?
Yeah, and of course, I mean, it sounds ridiculous because we're not Luddites. We want kids online. We want kids to take advantage of all of the new technologies, of course. We don't want them to be at a disadvantage. But at what cost? And just because these companies say it's all in the interest of helping our kids, well, things can go terribly wrong. Anyway, really interesting stuff. Maybe I'll bring this up again when Will is back, because I bet he'll have some interesting things to say, both as a parent and someone who's closely following education issues. But go look it up, guys. When you go home, or if you're at home, look this up. Try to find out what your schools are doing. Try to find out what these contracts are with your school districts. Because, frankly, I think if parents aren't the ones pushing for answers on this, I'm not sure if they're going to happen. All right. Coming up, I want to continue the school theme. Got some fun / horrifying stories to share from the school front. So stay tuned. That's coming up on Kane and Cup.
You're listening to Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network. You're listening to Kane and Cup.
Hey, it's Essie Cup. This is Kane and Cup. Talking it up on the Kane and Cup talk show. Does that work? I do that?
That's pretty close.
I have John, my husband, in studio. What?
Hey.
What? What's the big deal? We were just talking about data mining our kids, which sounds maybe like a cool thriller, like a cool new movie.
Yeah, it's a scary movie.
It's a scary movie. Data mining our kids. But it is. It's scary. And Glenn from Pennsylvania, I think, has an example of data mining our kids. Glenn, what do you have to tell me?
First of all, good morning and hello. And we love the show and listen every week.
Oh, thanks, Glenn.
Right to it. And I totally miss out on talking to Will. That's a huge bummer. But I love you and you guys are great. So let me get right to it. Basically, my oldest child is going to go into middle school next fall. The middle school she attends or will attend uses biometric fingerprint scanning to access their lunch accounts, which
what?
Is not happening. So I did some research into the company that facilitates this, and you have to follow me step by step, and I can take you to a very scary place, or in my opinion, a scary place. But basically, the company that facilitates this for the school district is called Identimetrics, and they do this in like 45 states. Mm-hmm. So they have a huge database of kids who are doing this. Mm-hmm. Well, Identimetrics has a partner called Secugen. Secugen has a partner called the Biometric Consortium. And let me just read to you right from the Biometric Consortium's webpage, and this is where, to me, it gets scary. Mm-hmm. The Biometric Consortium, supported by the National Institute of Standards and Technology and the National Security Agency, NSA, exists to facilitate scientific and technical interchanges between the U.S. federal government and outside entities on biometric and other identity technologies in support of defense, homeland security, identity management, border crossing, and e-commerce. Wow. This is horrible. And
Glenn, did you do all this research on your own?
Absolutely. It's
wow.
As simple SE as going to, say, the partners page on the identity or Identimetrics website.
Yeah.
And you can click on their partners and you can find Secugen. If you go to Secugen, you can find the Biometric Consortium. And right on the Biometric Consortium's main page, they're talking about their links to the NSA and the federal government and Homeland Security. It's absolutely ridiculous. There's no way in hell, pardon me, my kid is going to access their lunch account by biometric fingerprint scanning. Absolutely not.
Well, good for you. I mean, thanks for your call, Glenn. Good for you for, A, doing that research yourself. I mean, parents have to be proactive. I don't know that every parent would take that initiative to, or take the time to follow the breadcrumbs like that and try to figure out what's going on. But that is truly, truly scary. And good for you for not standing up for it. Thanks for calling in. That's nutso.
Nutso. And I think most parents would just accept it as fact and ignore
it.
Yeah,
what can you do? What can you do? You throw your hands up. You say, what can you do?
And their kids are going to be on file forever.
So I have a crazy story. I'm sure you heard about this week. A girl in Texas arrested on fraud charges for posing as a 15-year-old. She spent a year in high school. She's actually 31.
31?
She was 31.
Is this 31 Jump Street? Is that the joke?
Were you holding that?
Yeah, I've been working on that. did it work?
It worked. It worked. 31 Jump Street. Yeah. Here's what I understand. High school was horrendous. I hated every moment of it. Honestly, I hated every moment of it. I loved college. College is where I, finally felt comfortable as a human. High school was awful. Why would anyone want to go back?
I was pretty awesome at high school.
You know, I bet this is the thing. I bet it's different for dudes. This was actually a girl, but and I guess there's suggestion that she was homeless and she was going back to kind of get foster care. I don't know why she's back. I bet there's a difference between dudes and girls, because dudes would want to go back to high school to be like awesome at sports.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Would you want to go back to high school and like put your hockey skills to good use against like 14-year-olds?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I would dominate on the rink at 35 now.
Well, your beard definitely would.
Yeah, I'd have to keep this pretty clean shaven, I'm afraid. It'd be, if I wanted to blend.
It'd be weird.
Yeah.
You'd be driving to high school as like a Yeti. It's a little conspicuous.
Yeah.
God, I cannot imagine anything really worse than going back to high school.
No, but I'll tell you what.
What?
I would still be terrible at math.
Yeah, no, I think that's one thing that doesn't change. Like, if you're bad at math, you don't get smarter because you get older.
No.
I'm not smarter at math.
No, I'm worse at math.
I might be worse at math, too.
Yeah.
I might be worse at math.
I would be held after class at 35 years old because I couldn't do my equations.
Right, equations. Yeah.
I think that's a math term.
Science. Fact. As smart and confident as you get in like your social life, I think I'd still be like really uncomfortable and not great at having friends. I'm good at having friends now. Yeah, but I don't think I'd be any better at having friends or fitting in high school today than I did at 15.
Yeah, isn't there like a chick flick rom-com about this? Like, never been kissed or something?
Yeah, or something. As if you don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, asking for a friend.
Right.
Yes, there is. It's Never Been Kissed with Drew Barrymore, where she goes back to high school as a reporter. She's embedding to write stories. So at least there's a purpose there. I just can't imagine wanting to like hang out in high school. That was the worst.
Once again, I liked high school a lot. I was pretty good at it.
Yeah, I hate people who like high school, who liked high school, who were good at high school.
But we don't know this woman's motivation for this, do we?
Well, what they're saying is she didn't do anything really. She didn't like steal anything. She was actually pretty good. She was a good student. People liked her. She made a lot of friends. Maybe she's got some issues. I don't know.
Maybe she wanted a second chance at prom or something.
Maybe. No thanks for me. I'm all set. All right, stay tuned. We've got a friend joining us in the next block. You don't want to miss it. I think you're going to like him. Kane and Cup.
This is Kane and Cup,
part of the next generation of talk radio
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Cup. Hey, it's Essie Cup. Will Kane is not with us today. He's in rehab. I'm just kidding. He's not in rehab. He's at a family event. Unless that's code for rehab. Just saying. You can ask him when he gets back next week. I want to go to my friend on the phone. You might know Jesse Kelly. Jesse Kelly has been on Real News. In fact, I think he was on Real News this week. Jesse Kelly is a Marine. He's an Iraq War veteran. He was a congressional candidate for Arizona 8, I believe. And he was formerly the development director at Citizens United. You've definitely seen him. He's a very good friend of mine. He's also the tallest person I know.
He's hard to miss.
He is hard to miss. Jesse, how's it going?
I'm the tallest person you know?
Oh, hands down. I don't know Yao Ming. So yeah, you're the tallest person I know.
I am 6'8", which I realize is abnormal circus freak tall. I realize
it's absurd.
That, but don't tell me of all the people that SC Cup knows, you don't know one person taller than me.
I don't know one person taller than you. I have John with me. You know my husband, John.
I've heard of him. Yeah, I've heard of John. I heard he likes hockey, though, so we don't need to start going into that boring stuff that my sons are into now. We just don't even need to break that down, do we, John?
Are your sons playing hockey now?
Yeah, well, playing hockey is a big, that's a pretty generous term for it. The littlest one just falls down on the ice and stays there, and the biggest
isn't that hockey?
Actually, yeah, he's going to be an enforcer of some kind, but the smallest one is completely useless.
Nice. Well, here's my first question to you. We were just talking about this woman in Texas, actually where you live, in Texas, who posed as a 15-year-old. Did you hear about this? She's actually 31.
I heard. This is the lady that was a high school sophomore at the age of 31, correct?
Yes, and I want to know, what amount of money would it take for you to go back to high school as a 30-something-year-old?
Oh, I'd do it for free. for free? Are you kidding me? No responsibility in the world. You're just old enough to make a bunch of stupid decisions, but nobody holds you accountable for anything yet. Oh, it would be absolutely wonderful. Plus, by now, I'm bigger than everybody, so I would absolutely rule the school and just bully at will.
Would you say you were good at high school?
A good kid? No, I was a terrible kid in high school.
But were you good at being in high school?
Yeah, I was good at being in high school, actually. High school was, that was prime territory for me. Now, if you were to ask my teachers, they wouldn't reinforce that. But, yeah, I was a great high school student. After that, I struggled really at the rest of life.
I don't think that's true. I think you won the rest of life as well. Let me just inform our listeners, if you ever have the pleasure of going out to dinner with Jesse Kelly, let me give you a couple of tips. He will judge your order and he will judge it harshly. I went to a steak restaurant. Admittedly, it was a steak restaurant in New York City with Jesse and some friends. I believe Will Kane was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the audacity to order fish in front of Jesse Kelly. Well, he was not having that.
Look, you have to have some standards in your life, Essie. All right? You can't just aimlessly wander through life without ever holding yourself accountable. And when you walk into one of the best steak restaurants I've ever had, and you order the fish sticks or whatever it is that you ordered, that's unacceptable. All right? It's completely unacceptable. You know what? It's beneath you. This is not Uganda where you have to just eat whatever's in front of you. We live in this country. The founding fathers fought so that we could eat whatever the hell we want about 200 years later.
No, but apparently I can't eat whatever the hell I want because Jesse Kelly's there to tell me what I have to have.
Sometimes what you want is wrong, and you really need to just, it's just raising your standards. That's what it is.
You're like a taller Ron Swanson, right? Because we agree that fish is basically a vegetable, right?
It is. It is. And Swanson's Pyramid of Greatness is still the greatest minute and a half of television in history.
We don't even have to do a game of bros this week. You guys are just broing out for the rest of us. Okay, Jesse, the reason I wanted to have you on is because I wanted, as much as I love just joking around with you, I want you to tell our listeners your story, because I think it's one that they're really going to appreciate. Start with, you know, you get out of the service and start with the idea to run for office and take me through to where you are now.
Wow. All right. Let me see if I can do this so it's at least semi-interesting for radio. I get out of the Marine Corps. I just got back from Iraq. About 2 or 3 months later, that was the end of my time in the Marine Corps. And I get out, I move to Arizona, and I've always loved U.S. history and the military and all those things. Those things always fascinated me. But I hate politicians. Always have, always will. Politics itself kind of disgusts me. Pretty much grosses me out for the most part. Never had a desire to run for office, ever. But I was, you know, going to PCC Institute, which a lot of people call Pima Community College. It's a highly esteemed place in Tucson, Arizona. And I was working full-time, basically, managing construction projects. And Obama got elected, or was about to be elected. And I knew he was going to be elected. And I knew what a complete disaster he would be for the country. And I just got mad, just like everybody else. I just got mad. And I decided to run for Congress, having never been involved in politics, never running for office. And I realized that's kind of going 0 to 60, and everybody told me I was crazy. But along the way, I met a million people that helped me out, you included, that helped me go from out of nowhere to miss the election by 4,000 votes. Actually, Gabrielle Giffords was my opponent, and she beat me by 4,000 votes in a seat that people said couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after that, I wasn't sure where I was going to go, but decided to run again in the special election against Ron Barber, where he absolutely just wiped the floor with me.
Which is crazy, because he is a nut job.
He is. He's not my cup of tea. I wish I'd have won that one, but there's, you know, God has better plans, I guess. And after that, I decided I still wanted to be in the fight somehow. I really did not want to be a politician still, so I went to D.C. for a little while to work for Citizens United. And while I was there, for a lot of different reasons, I mean, for one, I don't really want to raise my kids there. I don't want to, you know, order Subway sandwiches through bulletproof glass in certain places and things like that.
Right.
I just, and I don't like to say this a lot because I know that for whatever reason, sometimes I have an influence on people around me. I really got disillusioned with not necessarily politics, because politics has always been disgusting and corrupt, and people think that it's worse now than ever. I mean, read Roman times. It's always been awful. Always.
Yeah.
I just got, to be totally honest, kind of grossed out with the way the country was going with the American people. With with every poll I'd see and everything I see, everybody wanting something for nothing. Everybody's completely sensitive in this country. You can't say anything anymore. Everybody's always offended about something, and that term just grosses me out. I'm offended by this. I'm offended by that. Everyone wants the government to hand them something. And so, to be totally honest, I washed my hands of it. I decided I'm done with this. I'm going to go make some money, put my kids in sports somewhere, love my wife, and see my family every night. And so we packed up without a job or anything else, and we moved to Texas. Found a small town called Frisco, right outside of Dallas, that we love, working in the private sector, making great money, and that is my story. I know that's brief boring, but that's my story.
No, how'd you pick Texas, and how'd you pick Frisco? Because I remember when you guys were leaving D.C., we were living there, and, you know, sad to see you go, and you kind of didn't know where you were headed to.
Well, that one we stepped out in faith, actually. We're both, my wife and I, are Christian people, and we just knew, we didn't know where we were supposed to go. We just knew we weren't supposed to be in D.C. So I quit the job without having a place to go or a job, and we actually just threw the family in the minivan, and we started driving through all the states that kind of hold the values we believe, through the Carolinas and Tennessee and just everywhere. And we actually ended up flat broke and busted in Dallas without anything in the world. We had no jobs. I'd applied all across the place. Wasn't even sure what I was supposed to do. And then had a random conversation with my mother, who told me Chuck Swindoll, a lot of your people will know who Chuck Swindoll is. He's a famous pastor. He puts out little devotionals he always has. I'd read in my whole life. She said he had a church up in Frisco. And so I said, yeah, you know, let's go see. And we drove up to Frisco, walked into Chuck Swindoll's church. We were in the lobby for 2 minutes, hadn't even met anybody, and we said, this is where we're moving.
Wow.
Went shopping for a house, bought a house the next 2 days, and moved to Frisco across the country with no job. So that's how we ended up here. I know we're crazy, but that's how we got.
No, this is why I wanted you on, because I love that story. It's an American story. I think it's a relatable story. I think it's an inspiring story. And, you know, gosh, there's just so much to love about your service, both to our country, to your family, to American values. I mean, I just love it. And I know that our listeners love it, too. So we'll look forward to seeing you more, hopefully on The Blaze and you know, anywhere else you turn up, Jesse. So keep us posted on your life. I know you will.
I will keep you posted, and you know how much I love you and John, so anytime you guys want to talk, you know I'm a phone call away.
Oh, great. Well, we'll definitely have you back, Jesse. Say hi to Aub and the kids, and we'll come visit you soon.
Take it easy, you guys. Stop watching NASCAR.
That's when I hate him just a little. All right. Well, that was my friend Jesse Kelly. Take a minute and look him up. He's a great guy, and feel really, really honored to know him, and I was glad he was able to tell you all his story. Okay, when we come back, there's news you can lose. We did this last week. It is literally news you can hear and then pretend it never happened. Just toss it right out. That's coming up on Kane and Cup.
This is Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.
Will Kane and SE Cup return?
Hey, it's SE Cup. Welcome back to Kane and Cup. I'm joined here by my husband, John.
Hey, everyone.
I want to get to news you can lose. Exactly. This is your news you can lose bulletin. It's news you can lose. Can I make it any clearer? This is not really news. But some good stories here. Did you know that there is an app called What's Applebee's? It's an iPhone app that lets you chat with other patrons at Applebee's. Like, has that been a desire that you've ever had?
Like you're sitting at the bar or at a table and you see someone across the same restaurant, or just like an Applebee's in like Modesto or something?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I didn't think there were any good questions about this story, but that's a good question.
I'm just curious.
I don't know, but it seems like, you have to be in an Applebee's to have anonymous conversations with other Applebee's patrons and brand advocates.
Brand advocates.
You must really like Applebee's if you want an app that lets you talk to other people at Applebee's about Applebee's.
I'm downloading it right now.
Yeah, you are. Story number two. The father of the Chicken McNugget has died.
No.
Yes. Herb Lotman, who helped conceive of the Chicken McNugget, developed the mass production system for making McDonald's frozen hamburgers, has died at age 80.
Hero.
Oh, yeah.
Nuggets are my catnip.
I mean, nuggets solve all problems.
It's a sad day.
It is sad. And finally, story number three, a news you can lose. Oakland outfielder Josh Reddick, a.k.a. maybe the coolest guy I know, second to you, has chosen as his walk-up song, you know how baseball players walk up to bat.
Yeah, they're at bat.
To songs.
Mm-hmm.
He chose Careless Whisper by George Michael.
That's fantastic.
It's amazing. I love it. I love it. It's like an 80s yacht rock slow jam.
Never gonna dance again.
Never gonna dance again. And apparently the A's fans love it.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. If you were playing in Major League Baseball, what would your at bat walk up song be?
Not that I have thought of this before, but it's clearly Thunderstruck.
What's Thunderstruck?
AC/DC.
Oh, wow.
It's probably a little generic, but
but you've not thought about this before.
Only every day.
I like the courage that Josh Reddick has to choose Careless Whisper and not a hyper masculinized AC/DC song like you, but a ballad.
I agree.
A heartfelt, haunting ballad.
Yeah, that's some courage. Proud of him.
To the heart and mind.
Converted fan now.
Ignorance is kind. So good. That's so good. I mean, you have an impulse to choose something that's like upbeat, fast, a lot of drums, because you want to get like psyched in, like a workout song.
Like the old jock rock albums.
Sure, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like when I work out, like I, you know, or I go for a walk or something, I need like psych me out music. I can't imagine like on the treadmill I'd want Careless Whisper, but it's awesome.
What would your at bat song be?
Probably something by Queen, like Don't Stop Me Now. That's a good one.
It's a good one.
Queen's pretty good. Yeah, Queen covers all the bases. No pun intended. Ayo. Okay, coming up in the next hour, it's pretty good. We're going to talk to my doctor friend about really stupid medical questions. If you have one, tweet me at SE Cup. Keep in mind, he is a psychologist. I don't want to know about toe fungus. Ask me questions about, like, the mind.
You're listening to
That's coming up,
Kane and Cup.
Part of the next generation of talk radio.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Kane and Cup, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
I was clearly on the outer edge of the nostril.
I know what I saw.
But there was no pig. I did not pig. There was no pig.
I gotta go.
No. No pig.
And what if I did do it? Even though I admit to nothing and never will. What does that make me? And I'm not here just defending myself, but all those pickers out there who've been caught. Each and every one of them. Who has to suffer the shame and humiliation because of people like you. Are we not human? If we pick, do we not bleed? I am not an animal.
Welcome back to Kane and Cup. I'm Ezzy Cup. Well, Kane's out today. He's enrolling in high school as a 40-year-old.
He looks like he's going to blend in just fine.
Yeah, he's neither 40, nor is he enrolling in high school. He's just off for a family event, but that would be really funny. I bet Will Kane could go back to high school because he has trouble growing a beard.
Yeah, he'd fit right in.
Yeah. Seinfeld the pick. This comes to my mind this weekend because, and I'm hoping you missed this. This was not important news, but it did go viral for a minute. Congressman Joe Garcia in Florida caught on camera eating his own earwax.
Gross.
Eating his own earwax. What'd you say, John? He does belong in high school. There you go. What's bizarre to me is he's on camera. He is on camera. The woman next to him is at a hearing speaking. He knows he is in the line of sight. And he picks his ear and eats it. Now, he says he's eating a hangnail. I'm not convinced. Go to YouTube. You say. You be the judge. But it brought me, it made me think, we need to get a doctor on this show because we need some credibility here.
Is there nutritional value?
Well, that's what I want to know, among other things. So I have my friend, Dr. Ryan Fuller. Ryan Fuller is brought on serious shows to be asked serious questions as a psychologist. He is currently the clinical director of New York Behavioral Health, and he has a private practice in Manhattan. You probably have seen him on television. I have seen him on television. He's very, very talented. Now, we're not going to take advantage of those talents today. Today, we're going to abuse them because I have some very not important but very interesting questions for Dr. Ryan Fuller. And I'm very glad, Dr. Ryan, that you've obliged me. You are a very good friend.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so I want to start.
My credibility at the door.
No need. No need. We need some sprucing up around here. My first question: is there a psychosis where people eat their own sort of bodily? What do you call them? Like earwax, stuff like that. Is that a psychosis? I know. There's like a pica, something. But tell me what's going on when a guy on camera picks his ear and eats it.
Yeah, secretions, I guess, is maybe the we'd call it.
I knew we had you on for a reason.
I heard the Seinfeld warm-up, and I think Seinfeld kind of had it backwards, but he was trying to normalize it, which is when he said, I'm not an animal, and I think we are animals. And, if it was a hangnail or a secretion, my guess is this is something he, like many of us, probably something we do in private. We don't want to make public. And he lost track of where he was and wasn't paying attention to cues. And that's kind of unfortunate. But if that's the upper limit on disgusting behaviors and bad decision making by our politicians, we're probably going to be in pretty good shape soon.
You're right, if that's as bad as it gets. Do you think that's a common thing?
I don't know about that particular one in terms of earwax. I'm totally unaware of that, but I mean, certainly people unceremoniously cleaning their noses or licking their fingers or using their sleeves as a napkin. I mean, I think those are things that are sort of automatic, and sometimes people lose track of where they are. They're just sort of unaware. And in this day and age with cameras and the 24-hour news cycle, it's going to cost you, unfortunately.
I have a question from someone on Twitter. Naughty Nikki on Twitter says, lately, while having relations with my husband, I've been fantasizing about designing a house we don't have. Is that normal? What do you think?
It's not exactly something I've had a client present before, but I do think fantasies about all kinds of things are normal, if we're talking about normalcy in terms of what could be healthy. I mean, statistically, from a mathematical standpoint, it may not be that common. But if it's not hurting anyone, I mean, this is where your libertarian listeners probably will side with me. If you're not hurting anyone else and it's sort of adaptive and enhancing the sexual experience, I don't see any harm and typically probably encourage it.
Well, there you go. Naughty so. Nikki. Fantasize away.
Yeah,
all right. I want to ask you. Yeah, I want to ask you about Donald Sterling. You've heard this story, of course. The owner of the LA Clippers.
Yeah.
What is going on with that dude? Because put the racism aside, it seems like he can't get out of his own way. He gave an exclusive interview to Anderson Cooper on CNN, in which I thought he seemed a little senile. I mean, he didn't really do anything to help himself out in that interview. I mean, he threw Magic Johnson under the bus. He's being real stubborn. He won't pay the league's fine. Is this just a brazen old guy, or do you sense some senility or even some psychosis there?
I mean, I didn't see any signs of psychosis, but I mean, I would never want to try to diagnose someone just from seeing the footage. I did see some clips from Anderson Cooper. I mean, you know, there seemed to be some flaws in some of the reasoning, even in the clips I saw on Anderson Cooper. And, you know, dementia is a serious issue, and any time we move up into the 70s and 80s, you know, the probability that someone could be suffering from dementia increases. I have no idea what's going on for him, because it would require understanding what his functioning was before, because it's not just poor reasoning, it's a change in reasoning. So, I don't know if he's been reasoning like this all along, but, you know, it did appear if the goal of going on the show was to sort of improve his public image or repair race relations, he certainly didn't seem to be doing himself any favors, unfortunately. It seemed to go pretty poorly. And as you said, there even seemed to be discrepancies. One minute he was, you know, saying he admired Magic Johnson and respected him, and next moment he was saying things that kind of contradicted that. So I'm not sure if, you know, probably checking with his family and someone assessing him directly would be a good idea. But clearly there did seem to be some problems with the reasoning, for sure.
Whew. Yeah. All right, we've got a Twitter question from No Comment at No Comment. Says, why do the voices in my head only speak Spanish?
That's a good question. I obviously can't answer that. I have no idea. The person's, I guess, tweeting in English, so I'm assuming they speak both languages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it common that people who might be bilingual, or let's do this another way, people who are unilingual, can they think in other languages? Does that happen?
You have challenged the limits of my knowledge more times today than I get a typical day. Who knew?
I told you we're not going to use your talents today.
I don't know that I have any, but you've certainly surpassed them. I don't know the answer to that for sure. My guess would be if you speak one language, it would be less likely. I haven't heard of cases, but I'm sure there has to be some where they're hearing another language, even though, of course, if they can't speak the language, whether or not it's an accurate, fluent language that they're hearing is another story. So I don't know. You got some interesting tweets coming in.
Oh, tip of the iceberg, my friend. Tip of the iceberg. All right. My husband, John, is in the studio. He has a question for you.
Hi, John.
Hey, Dr. Fuller. Nice to see you.
Ryan is fine.
Someone who will remain nameless seems to have what I would deem irrational fear of sea life. And we're not talking sharks or moray eels or particularly scary. We're talking like Nemo, like clownfish, the cutest things in the sea. Where would you say these irrational fears might come from?
Hmm.
Well, I mean, first, this is going to sound crazy, but I don't know that I would call it an irrational fear, especially if the person who remains nameless is someone close to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fuller. That's so interesting to hear.
Sorry, I didn't know if I was going to be stepping there, but I thought. But for instance, it might be maladaptive if you're trying to plan like a snorkeling or scuba vacation.
Yes, it would get in the way.
So, I mean, there certainly are sort of like Freudian theories on this. That's not something I typically find a lot of scientific evidence for. I'm a behaviorist, so usually the explanation would be given would be some kind of early experience, either where something went awry when he or she was interacting with you know, a jumbo shrimp or Nemo or something.
Noted.
Wait, but you might, okay, so you don't put stock in them, but what are some of the Freudian explanations?
Well, most of the ones he gave, and I am the last person to pretend to be an expert on Freud. I'm probably the opposite of that.
Yep.
But you, from what I understand, and I haven't read a lot of primary sources on Freud because I am a behaviorist, but a lot of what he spoke about in terms of phobias had to do with men and had to do with sort of like fears about mother's genitalia and all these kinds of things. You know, there's not a lot of scientific evidence that makes a good, a clear at least explanation to me as to how that would come about or if it had, how we would measure or test it. I mean, the one thing is you also can develop a phobic response to something you've never had contact with. And someone can be phobic of flying without ever having gotten on an airplane, sort of learning vicariously through their parents. Or if you've never had contact with, I mean, I'm guessing, you know, you probably haven't run into an animated Nemo character before in real life.
No.
But you don't have to have, you don't have to have that contact to be afraid of it. Cause there could be cognitive factors where you saw a show or heard about it being disgusting or anything like that. Let me ask you, John, how is it affecting your life?
It makes some awkward experiences at the beach. For example, when a certain someone runs out of the water screaming because a cute little clownfish has appeared underwater.
Yeah, I mean, look, when I said I wouldn't call it an irrational fear, that doesn't mean I wouldn't suggest the person do something about it if it's causing a problem in their relationship. So, I mean, I don't consider the fears to be irrational. I consider high fear responses sometimes to be really maladaptive. So sometimes,
yes.
Sometimes the fear and the behavior that gets in the person's way, I don't call that irrational. It's maladaptive. Some of the beliefs they might have, like that fish is going to hurt me. There's a high probability it's going to attack. If it attacks, it's going to be dangerous.
Yes.
Those would be irrational. So it's not that I wasn't saying there isn't irrationality. I would just say there are irrational cognitions. The fear itself is an intense response that might be paired with an avoidant behavior that's going to cause problems in the relationship, or at least make vacations less relaxing if they involve the beach.
Well, I don't know to whom you are referring, John, but she sounds amazing.
just asking for a friend.
Well, Dr. Ryan, we really appreciate your advice. Actually, that last bit was very helpful. I will tell this awesome woman what you had to say about her totally rational fears. But thanks for coming on. We'll have you back because I know Will has some really stupid questions and he's going to want to pick your brain and abuse your talent. So if you wouldn't mind coming back, we'd love to have you.
Happy to. No stupid questions, only stupid people asking them. Happy to do it.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Ryan. We appreciate it. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, stay tuned. That was great, and thanks for tweeting in your questions. They were fun. That was fun. We'll have Dr. Ryan back. All right, coming up, there's more in Kane and Cup. You don't want to go away.
This is Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.
Seven? Yeah, I guess I could see it. Seven. Seven periods of school, seven beatings a day. Roughly seven stitches a beating, and eventually 7 years to life. Yeah, you're doing that child quite a service.
Yes, I am. I defy you to come up with a better name than Seven.
All right, let's see. How about Mug? Mug Costanza. That's original. Or Ketchup. Pretty name for a girl.
All right, you having a good time then?
I got 50 right here in the cupboard. How about Bisquick? Pimento? Gherkin, sauce, Maxwell House.
Kane and Cup.
I could, if pressed, I could find a way to open every single segment with a Seinfeld quote.
Fact.
This is SE Cup. Will Kane is out. That's all you need to know. Don't ask me why. I don't have the answers. He will be back next week. Just kidding. He's away for a family event. I've got John, my husband, in the studio with me. We've had a really fun show visited by lots of friends and fun people. And we've got one more guest in this hour. That's coming up in a little bit. But first, I want to... you actually sent me this, John. The story.
Mm-hmm.
The 22 most outrageous baby names of 2013. And that headline delivers.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, that headline delivers. No seven on the list. If you remember from that episode, George also liked the name Soda.
Were there any numbers?
No. No numbers. Let me start here. I can't believe, what's amazing about this is that it's not just one example of someone naming their kid this. They show you a number of people have named their kids these things. This is crazy. Let me start with girls. What would you think about the name Rarity? Rarity.
Rarity?
Rarity.
First of all, it sounds tough to spell.
Second, well, it's a noun and pretty common, so I think you could spell it. Rarity.
I don't know why people do this to their children.
Seven different people named their kid Rarity last year.
Well, then you're not rare anymore.
No. False.
One of seven.
Not Rarity.
Yeah, you're pretty common.
Pretty common. Common. There are six others.
More like commonality.
Commonality.
Yeah.
Six people named their daughter Charlemagne.
Charlemagne was like a French king.
Dude. Yeah. Snowy. Five people. Snowy. It's a pet. That's a pet.
It's a weather condition.
That's a dog. That's a white cat.
Yeah, that's a forecast.
That's a forecast. This one, I don't know. You might like.
Mm-hmm.
Pistol.
For real?
For real. Nine people.
That's money.
Pistol.
It's a great nickname. Pistol Pete, things like that. But for a primary name.
What, John? Well, yeah. I mean, if we're just throwing all the rules out the window, I mean, why not?
But I think in today's day and age, I don't think a child named Pistol would be allowed in their school.
No. You're right. You bring up a good point. With the gun crazy culture, the anti-gun crazy culture we live in, I bet people would be really offended by that. We're going to talk about guns in the next block, so that's a perfect segue. But first, let me go to the boys. The boys. These are even better. Subaru. Like the car.
No, that's impossible.
It's not only possible, but five people named their son Subaru last year.
Is there no copyright infringement?
I mean, you can name your kid whatever you want.
Were they paid by Subaru to name their kids that as a promo?
I don't think so. Subaru.
There's no justification.
Someone on Twitter joked to me when I posted this week that if you named your kid Subaru Outback, it could be the answer to every question, like, where's our son? Subaru Outback. Mm-hmm. He also, the same person on Twitter told me, believe this or not, that he knows someone who has twins named Duncan and Donut.
No.
I challenged him and I said, you're lying. That's not true. He said, it's absolutely true. They love Dunkin' Donuts, which so do we.
Right.
Because we grew up in New England, of course.
Right.
Weaned on Dunkin' Donuts. I would never name our kids Duncan and Donut. That's crazy pants.
Maybe iced coffee.
Maybe iced hazelnut skim with one Splenda. Full name. Full name.
I bet you get some Starbucks out there, though. I guarantee it.
Another son named Forever. There's six of those. Forever.
No, terrible.
Power.
I'm
Power.
Okay. Yeah, it's not bad.
You're such a bro.
Anyone named Awesome?
Warrior.
Warrior.
Six of those.
Pretty good.
Tough. T-U-F.
Perfect.
There's eight of those.
That is awesome.
See, now you're just broing out. You're not thinking like a human who would have a kid who would have to go through life with the name T-U-F.
No, these aren't my kids.
So you don't care?
No. I think it's unfair to the kid, but...
Yeah, you think?
But it's entertainment value for me.
You think?
I'm entertained.
I don't understand the psychology. This is a good one for Dr. Ryan. What is the psychology behind naming your kid something truly terrible?
I think you think you're helping him. You're really hurting.
No, I think you're really selfish, and you think you're being awesome, and you're not. Mm-hmm. And you think your kid is a reflection of how cool and interesting you are.
Barf.
Barf. Okay, stay tuned. Coming up, I want to talk about a really sad story. Remington, you know Remington, they make great guns. Leaving New York. We're going to tell you why next, Kane and Cup.
You're listening to Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome back to Kane and Cup. I'm SE Cup. You can tweet me at SE Cup. You can call in to the Broad Voice line at 888-900-3393. Will Kane's out today. Probably just eating his own earwax, as he does.
That's why he's on radio.
That's why he's on the radio. So he can just sit there all day and eat his own earwax and no one knows.
Delicious.
Gross. Now, he's out at a family event. He will be back next week. But I've really enjoyed hanging out with you guys today and running my own show. It's been fun. I want to tell you, this will not be a shocking story to you, nor is it news you can lose. It is news you can use, but it's news that is not going to surprise you. Remington Outdoor Company, you all know Remington guns, Remington rifles. Remington is especially known for its Bushmaster rifle and its Remington Model 1911 pistol. Those production lines are being moved from its famous old plant in Ilion, New York, to a new facility in Huntsville, Alabama. Ostensibly because it's more gun rights friendly. It's really, really sad. It's sad for the community of Ilion, which depends on Remington. It's sad for gun rights. It's sad for New York. But we knew this would happen. I mean, for people who know me, and I talk about gun rights a lot on Real News and on The Blaze and everywhere else I can, we knew this would come. And if there's a silver lining here, it's good that gun manufacturers are sort of voting with their feet. We knew that that was going to happen. I have a guest today who wrote about this for Forbes and who has a new book coming out called The Future of the Gun. So he works on these issues. His name is Frank Miniter. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, good to be here, Essie.
Tell me a little of the backstory here. Tell me, you wrote about this in Forbes. Tell me sort of the Chuck Schumer connection and the ROC move and what that all means.
Right. And Remington's been consolidating their many assets for a long time. And one thing they did is they bought Bushmaster firearms from Maine down to New York. And Senator Schumer at the time posed for a photo op and put a press release on his website boasting about how great this was. They're bringing 40-something jobs to make these assault weapons, as he would call them, in Ilion, New York, which is actually our oldest manufacturing plant still making its original product. It's almost 200 years old. Always has made guns there since 1816. And he thought, isn't that great? Well, and pretty soon after that, of course, he got vocal again, which he supported before, a national assault weapons ban, which we had from 94 to 2004 in the United States. He's advocating that again, and he went on Meet the Press and a lot of other shows saying, we need to have this assault weapons ban nationally all over again. Well, it's a huge piece of hypocrisy there, because he was boasting about bringing those assault weapons, so-called assault weapons jobs, to Ilion, New York, to his constituency as his senator from New York.
Yeah, let me just, for our listeners, let me read part of that, because you included it in your piece. He the press release said, today, U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer joined Remington officials and plant employees to announce that Bushmaster Firearms is relocating a manufacturing facility from Windham, Maine to Ilion, New York, bringing over 40 new jobs to Central New York in the process. Schumer's been a longtime supporter of manufacturing at the Remington plant, urging top Army officials to open up competition for the Army's small arms contracts to other U.S. manufacturers and domestic producers across the country, like the Ilion, New York-based Remington. Today, Schumer applauded Remington's decision to add new jobs to the productive and capable workforce, already making the factory an economic powerhouse in the Mohawk Valley. Now, Frank, you get to this in your piece, but do you think Chuck Schumer knows what an assault weapon is? Do you think he could tell me what makes an assault weapon an assault weapon?
Well, it's a political definition. That's the whole trouble with it.
Exactly.
It was passed by Governor Cuomo right after that Newtown shooting and all. He was boasting about passing the first restrictive gun control. They try to define what that is, and everything from 1187 shotgun, which is a semi-automatic shotgun invented in 1962 that's used by millions of hunters and skeet shooters and things, that's considered an assault weapon if it has a pistol grip on it.
Right, or a flash suppressor or some other like cosmetic feature that really has nothing to do with making the gun any more powerful or potent.
Right, it's a massive, expansive list. And so it's a total political definition. And so right now, actually, the sale of those firearms, the Bushmasters and many more, is illegal in New York State. You have to register them. In fact, you've already had to register them by April 15th if you actually have one. How many register them is actually a whole other issue and a whole other story. There's something like 1 million people at the National Shooting Sports Foundation says have those firearms in New York State, yet the state police won't tell us how many have actually registered them. It's, from what I can tell, anecdotally, it's a very small percentage.
Yeah, so what I like here is that you have a real specific example of how a legislator not just is hypocritical, because we see that all the time, but my problem with this issue has always been that the people who are most vocal on the gun control side know the least about gun issues. They know the least about how guns work. They know the least about gun ownership, and they know the least about gun crime. And yet they're passionate and vocal and emotional and indignant about gun ownership. And in many cases, these are the people with the biggest microphones in front of them.
Right. That's exactly right. The mainstream media has no idea what they're talking about with this issue, and they're not really interested in finding out. That's why I ran around doing a book on this topic that'll be out this summer, because it's time that we start to actually teach some of these people what these guns are and what they do, what actually reduces gun violence and so on.
Yeah, and another thing that you bring up here, which I think most people don't know, is the economic impact of the gun industry. And it's not a burgeoning industry that we need to help out. It's doing really, really well. You have some stats here from the NSSF, and I've talked to Larry Keene at NSSF about this a lot. He told me that between 2008 and 2013, there was 48% job growth in the firearms industry. So while jobs are lacking in other sectors, in the firearms industry, they're actually exploding.
And it's interesting, too, because if you crunch the numbers, you find out in 2012, for example, 66% of the guns made available for sale in the United States were actually made in the United States. How many hard metal manufacturers are actually two-thirds of their product are still made in the United States?
Well, yeah, this is, as you point out, I mean, if we're all going to bemoan the death of manufacturing and we're going to talk about political ways that we can bring it back to malign gun manufacturers, to malign gun owners, would seem the last thing you'd want to do.
And you know, that Remington Pratt & Illion, it's just the coolest place in the world. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to go through it. They even had this machine, when I first visited there in 2007, they called the Willy Wonka machine. You know, it was invented in the 1960s. It had all these swinging arms and wheels and belts, and you stuck a big piece of metal in one end, and all the sparks flew out and smoke came out, and this little piece of a trigger mechanism for a Model 870 shotgun would pop out the other end. You know, they've since gotten rid of that machine. It's all modern CNC stuff, but it's just the coolest 200-year-old factory, and they're slowly killing it.
Yeah, you can still visit it, though, right? I mean, it's still open, and there's a gun museum there.
It's a great museum. It's a neat place.
Well, tell us real quick what the future of the gun, what you're going to talk about in this book.
You know, I went with inner-city gang members to see where they get their guns, and actually what I really found interesting about them is that they all said the gun control doesn't work, and that actually they say it actually makes crime worse, and it actually lets them do things that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise if citizens could have the right to bear arms. So I go there. I go to the R&D departments of the major gun manufacturers. I went with sheriffs, police departments, the ATF, which is a real interesting organization to dig into, very political and strange, but also full of great people. It's just a weird mix of stuff. So I go through all those different parts of the whole gun business, gun industry, to get down to the bottom truth of what that really means to America and how our link to firearms, what that really means.
Well, that sounds great. I can't wait to read it. And hopefully when the book is out, Frank, you'll come back and talk about it with us.
Oh, anytime, Missy.
All right, Frank Miniter, thanks so much. You can check out his piece on Forbes, America's Oldest Gunmaker Thumbs Its Nose at a Two-Faced Senator. The senator they're talking about there is Chuckie Schumer. And look out for The Future of the Gun. That's Frank's book coming out this summer. Okay, stay tuned. There's a little bit left in this Will Cain-less Cain and Cup. You don't want to miss it.
Will Cain and S.E. Cup.
We'll continue in a moment on the Blaze Radio Network.
Cain and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hey, it's Essie Cup. Will Kane. Will Kane is out of the country. Will Kane is on a covert mission somewhere. No, he's at a family thing. He'll be back next week. I know we all missed him today, but I hope you enjoyed spending the morning with me. And my husband, John, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Yeah. One last story. You know Wes Welker.
Yeah, big fan.
Because you're a Patriots fan.
Of course.
Yeah. Wes Welker, is he still with the Patriots?
No, he's with the Broncos now.
Right, okay. Nonetheless, he went to the Kentucky Derby.
Correct.
Left a big winner.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He needed it.
But why? Why do you say that?
I'm joking. He's a pro football player.
Oh, yeah. All right. Isn't he? He's a little guy, right?
He's a little guy.
Teeny tiny?
Yeah.
Yeah. He left with 15,000 more than he should have.
Wow.
And through no fault of his own, the thing at the cashier's window.
They had a tote.
Whatever that means. I don't know these terms. What's the tote?
It's like the machine place where you put your ticket in, and it determines if you won, you get your money back.
Well, it was broken. It gave him 15,000 more than he should have won.
Jackpot.
Yeah. And I think it was someone representing him collected the money and they left with it, and Churchill Downs wanted it back. But he said, I'm not going to pay it back. It's your mistake. It's not my mistake. If you'd made a mistake in the other way, how would I have known? Right? That happens. I think eventually the latest I saw was that Churchill Downs is saying, you can keep it. You can keep it. Well, we just hope you come back.
But by law, Kentucky law, Churchill Downs is responsible for that money, not Wes Welker.
Well, right. It's not my fault.
No.
It's not Wes Welker's fault.
No.
It's your fault.
No.
You know, I was once at a casino. This is my all-time greatest casino story.
Of many.
Of many. It's true. I do like a good casino once in a while. I was at a casino in Atlantic City. It was very late, I'll say. It was early in the morning. And I'd had a couple drinks. I was with some friends. And I was with a friend who stupidly liked roulette. I play blackjack because I'm smart. But he liked roulette. And so I was playing roulette with him. And I put, you know, chips on black whatever, black 14, say. And spin the wheel. And the dealer takes the chips off. It landed on black. I said, wait a second. I had that one. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. I won that one. I was on black 16 or whatever. I was on it. I should get money for that. No, you didn't. My friends are like, stop talking. Don't do this. It's going to end badly.
Yeah, don't challenge the house.
You do not challenge the dealer. Me, I'm indignant. Go to the tape, I say. Go to the tape. And they did. And I was right.
Wow.
I know. That never happens.
Never happens.
I was right. They were apologetic. Gave me my money back, obviously. But I feel like casinos and gambling establishments probably don't get called often on mistakes they made. And because there's a human component to a lot of this, they make mistakes, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. They probably count on you not calling them out.
Exactamundo.
But here's my question about this story.
Yeah.
If you go to the ATM and it accidentally gives you more money than you requested or from a wrong account, that's not your money, even though it's no fault of your own. You
like if it's a bank, a private bank does that?
Yeah, that's not your money to keep.
It's not your money to keep.
Or if
I don't know how they could, I mean, if they caught it, I guess they could track you down and ask for it.
They would know. They'd send you a letter.
Yeah.
And if your business overpays you, that's
right.
Not your money.
That's true.
Not your fault.
That's
but
true.
Thanks to Kentucky law, Wes is in the right here.
Yes, thanks to Kentucky law.
But the other thing on this is mm-hmm. that Wes was photographed.
Yes.
Walking around, showing off wads of cash, handing it out like it was flower petals at a
good
wedding.
For him.
Wasn't his money.
But what if he didn't know that?
He didn't know that.
Right.
Right.
Right. Well, I think Churchill Downs, first of all, got great publicity out of this. Go to Churchill Downs,
free
win
money.
An extra $15,000.
Good return on investment here.
Yeah. So I think they were smart to drop this. Say someone famous won some extra money on our mistake. We'll let him keep it. We hope he comes back because I think he probably spent some money.
Well, this is like a restaurant or a bar giving a celebrity free drinks, right? I mean, you want them to come back. So here's a few extra vodka sodas on the house.
Yeah.
And you might come back next time.
Yeah.
Here's a few extra Benjamins on the house.
Have these Benjamins. Talk about us. Spread the word. Mm-hmm. And return.
Tweet at us.
Tweet about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're just going to give out Benjamins at the door. Yeah. Smart move, Churchill Downs and Wes Welker. Good for you.
Good for you.
Spread it around. He does some charity work.
I'm sure.
He's
a good guy. He's well liked.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I'm sure. Sure, he'll do some nice things with that money. And who knows? Maybe the next time you go to your favorite gambling establishment, you'll win a little more. It never works out that way.
That's never happened to me.
That doesn't happen. All right. Well, that does it for this week's Kane and Cup. We appreciate you joining us. Will Kane returns next weekend. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next week. Have a great weekend, guys.
You're listening to Kane and Cup on the Blaze Radio Network.